Thanks for joining us for a third episode of the Eastern Standard Special Series Democracy Optimist. Produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU, our series is written and hosted by Joshua Douglas, Professor of Election Law and Voting Research in the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
What does it mean? To be American.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law, with a dose of hope sprinkled in. If you ask Americans to name the most important rights within the U.S. Constitution, they'll probably say free speech, maybe freedom of religion, and the right to vote. But the U.S. Constitution doesn't actually confer the right to vote, at least explicitly. Professor Rick Hassan of the UCLA Law School, who is one of the nation's preeminent election law experts, thinks we need a constitutional amendment to add the right to vote to the Constitution. He's the curator of the Indispensable Election Law blog, the director of the UCLA Safeguarding Democracy Project, and the author of a new book titled A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
It's so great to be with you, Josh.
So first, the entire premise of your book is that the U.S. Constitution doesn't affirmatively protect the right to vote, something I, of course, know as a voting rights professor, but maybe that'll surprise many of our listeners. So why doesn't the Constitution confer the right to vote?
I think the answer goes back to the age of the Constitution. Remember, the Constitution goes back to the 1780s. At that time, there wasn't a belief in universal suffrage. Under the original Constitution, voters didn't have the right to vote for president. They didn't have the right to vote for Senate. We didn't get that till the beginning of the 20th century in the 17th Amendment. And as to the House of Representatives, it said there would be elections, but it said that states would get to set the rules. So early on, there was no right to vote put in the Constitution. The words right to vote don't even appear until after the Civil War. And they're generally phrased in the negative. If you're going to hold an election, don't discriminate on the basis of race or on the basis of sex, but no affirmative right to vote. And that has lots of repercussions even for today.
Yeah, and of course, the topic that is the subject of most amendments is the right to vote. But as you noted, all those amendments phrase it in the negative. No state may deny the right to vote on a certain basis. In the book, you write that we need to, quote, play offense instead of defense on the right to vote. What do you mean by that?
So if you look at the structure of how voting rights get expanded in this country, it generally happens in two ways. One way is through there being limits placed on who's allowed to vote. And then the response is to try to sue over those limits. I would call that's like, you know, you're going on the defense. The state starts on the offense by limiting voting rights. This goes back to 1874 when a woman named Virginia Minor went to the Supreme Court seeking to fight against her disenfranchisement as a woman in the Missouri Constitution, and she lost. It's Jackson Giles, a man who was a citizen and resident of Alabama, who was denied the right to register to vote in Alabama, despite the 15th Amendment, which prohibits discrimination in voting on the basis of race. He lost, despite the language of the 15th Amendment. So defense is essentially, trying to fight voting restrictions in court. And as you well know, Josh, from your own studies, the U.S. Supreme Court and from your great upcoming book, we'll see lots of examples of this. The U.S. Supreme Court is not the great protector of voting rights. In fact, you look at the 235-year history of the Supreme Court, I think we can count only about an eight-year period in the 1960s when the court was actually leading on voting rights. So to go on the offensive is to do like what happened in the 19th Amendment, where women, after losing in the Supreme Court, organized and passed a constitutional amendment that barred discrimination in voting on the basis of sex. So what we need to do is think broadly about how can we expand voting rights so that we have protection for everyone.
Yeah, and as you know, Nate, many people think of the Supreme Court as a protector of rights in general, and it has been in some instances, but certainly on the right to vote, it has a pretty sorry history. historically and more recently, and thanks for the shout out of my book that goes into some of those case law from the past 50 years. So your book, A Real Right to Vote, offers a proposal for a basic constitutional amendment with six parts. Walk us through the basic proposal.
So the idea is that some of the best protection we have for voting rights came from a set of Supreme Court rulings in the 1960s during the period of the Warren Court that read the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment as protecting certain voting rights. I'm concerned that these precedents in the hands of the current very conservative Supreme Court are not so steady. So at the beginning, I just try to codify those by saying that you can't discriminate in voting if someone is a citizen, adult, resident, non-felon, that people have the right to vote for all the offices in which where they are resident, and that includes for president. That would be changing Article 2 of the Constitution, which gives state legislatures the power to set the rules for conducting presidential elections. As recently as the year 2000 in the Bush versus Gore case that ended the dispute over the 2000 presidential election, the Supreme Court said state legislatures could take back that power at any time in future elections. It would also have equal weighting of votes. This is another one of those Warren Court precedents, the one person, one vote rule, also not contained in the text of the Constitution. I would also change the way that courts balance the burdens on voters against state interests, requiring that states come forward with real substantial evidence that when they're trying to restrict voting or registration, they have a very good reason to do so. I would also codify a part of the Voting Rights Act, commonly known as Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which provides that minority voters should have the same opportunity as others to participate in the political process, to elect representatives of their choice. I would make it clear that Congress has broad powers to enforce voting rights. And finally, I would set up a system where all voters would have to be automatic, if they're eligible, would have to be automatically registered to vote. And we'd have a kind of system of national ID so that all voters could be identified. So if you move from, say, Kentucky to California, your number would go with you and we could assure that people are not registered to vote or voting in two different places.
I want to bring out three things from your proposal that you just mentioned that I think are really important to emphasize. The first is that although the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly protect the right to vote, there's case law under the Equal Protection Clause. And so your proposal, as you said, is trying to put that case law on more solid footing in the Constitution. The second thing you pointed out is that the current court has been way too protective of states' rights in running elections and really allowing states to justify burdens on the right to vote without a lot of evidence. And then the third thing you say is this this kind of compromise of automatic voter registration, which already occurs in a handful of states, with a national voter ID. I think that's a compromise politically, right? You're trying to basically get Democrats and Republicans on board with things that each of them like. Tell us a little bit more about that kind of compromise.
Well, you know, one of the things that I start A Real Right to Vote with, and that carries me through, is looking how other democracies conduct their elections. So in most other democracies, if you think about modern democracies like Canada or Germany, in their constitution, they guarantee the right to vote. So, you know, all citizens over the age of 18. And in addition to that, all voters are automatically registered by the government. And the kind of automatic voter registration I'm talking about is broader than what states do, like my state of California, where you're going to be registered to vote if you have a driver's license, if you're eligible, unless you affirmatively decline. The state would have to proactively go out and find those voters who don't drive and would have to do more. But states, other countries also have national identity cards. And so if you were able to get rid of fights up in the states about voter registration and about voter ID, you'd eliminate a ton of the litigation that occurs around every election. You know, we are not normal as a country. Most other countries, even though they're polarized, they're not having lawsuit after lawsuit over what the rules are for conducting elections. Now, most of those countries have national nonpartisan election administrators. I've given up on that. That is something that back in a 2012 book called The Voting Wars, I advocated. But the local control is so strong here that I don't think we're going to change. And so I'm looking for a compromise. I'm looking for something that appeals to both voter access and concerns about election integrity. I don't think voter fraud is a major problem in this country, but it's enough of an issue that why not come up with a system that assures people, gives them confidence without having, you know, a way of undermining people's ability to be able to actually vote. So you marry these two things. You put the burden on the state to come forward with what all whatever the costs are to help verify that someone is who the person says they are, and then register them to vote, and it'll be registered for life. And when someone graduates from high school, they're going to automatically be added to the rolls, and they'll have that with them for their entire life.
You then go bolder, suggesting an amendment that would also tackle the Electoral College, the allocation of two U.S. senators per state, which obviously, you know, your state of California has two, and the very small state of Wyoming also has two senators, saying that both practices, the Electoral College and the Senate allocation, skew democracy. So which approach is better? And should we go all for broke and try to get it all? Or is the basic proposal the one that's more likely? And so that's what we should advocate for.
So I'm not a political activist. You know, I can only give kind of the ideas. And I think that really the question is, if we're going to have a movement to actually try to amend the Constitution and make voting rights central, what the scope of that is going to be up to the people who do that. And what I'm offering is a kind of menu. Here are the things that ideally I personally would put into a constitutional right to vote. But I recognize that some parts are more controversial than others, so I've carved them out so that you wouldn't necessarily have to include them. I think it really depends on whether or not there's the potential for movement towards getting some bipartisan buy-in on such a right to vote amendment. And let me talk about that, because lots of times when I'm speaking about this proposal, the first response is, well, it's never going to happen. Democrats can't even pass voting rights legislation. How are you going to get bipartisan agreement? And I have two answers to that. One is, I'm writing for a longer time horizon. If you think about the time between 1874, when the Supreme Court decided Minor versus Happersett and said that women did not have a right to vote protected under the 14th Amendment, and 1920, when the 19th Amendment was passed and ratified, that period of time, that's four decades. That's how we have to think. So we don't know what things are going to look like in upcoming decades. The other point is that as the Republican Party is changing, and as it is appealing more to poorer, less educated working class voters, the kinds of voting restrictions that some states put in place are more likely to disenfranchise these voters. So there may be a moment where it is in the political interest of both parties to broadly protect voting rights. And if the parties actually care about voter access and care about election integrity, there's something in it for both of them. I can't tell you exactly where that compromise might be. And so I'm laying out the various ways of thinking about, you know, how broad a scope that amendment could go.
So you note that a right to vote amendment could also reduce election litigation. Now, of course, you know, election law, election litigation keeps people like you and me in business in terms of what we get to talk about. But you know, lowering the amount of litigation surely would be better for the country. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, why a right to vote amendment would reduce litigation and why that would be beneficial?
So in the period since the 2000 election, the amount of election litigation in this country has nearly tripled. This litigation is partly the product of state-by-state legislation trying to change the voting rules, often to try and obtain partisan advantage. I'm not sure that it does, but it certainly creates uncertainty. That can create conditions where voters' confidence in the process is lowered. I mean, there's just lots of reasons to worry that the confidence in the election system, as it decreases, actually hurts our democracy. You look at the polling about how many Republicans believe that the last election was stolen. It's very concerning, especially because I think that despite the difficult conditions of the pandemic, the last election was maybe the best run presidential election we've had in this country. And so there's, you know, there's a real concern about voter confidence. And litigation, in addition to changing the rules and making it hard for voters to know what the rules are and making it harder for election officials to know, it can undermine people's confidence. We should have clear rules. The thumb should be on the scale favoring voters. But we have to have safeguards in place, as every state does to more or less degree, to assure that our system is not going to be open to manipulation, whether that's by voters, by election officials, or by someone else. And so I'm looking to try to lower the heat, make things more rational, make things both more secure, and provide greater voter access and equality.
So you wrote the book, as you said, for a longer term horizon, you know, 40 years, perhaps, when there might be a political moment where an amendment could pass. What should we do this year, legislatively or otherwise, to make sure the 2024 election goes off without a hitch?
Well, first, let me say that it's not as though I'm writing it so that nothing should happen for the next 40 years. I'm saying it's going to be a long term movement that may take that long. And I've actually, you know, I relied in part on your work, Josh, about state constitutions. So one of the things that we know is that every state's got a right to vote amendment in their state constitution. A lot of those were changed in the period between 1874 and 1920. A lot of those right to vote amendments were changed to guarantee women the right to vote as part of a political movement. Because we have such a decentralized system, we could see that again. So some, as you well know from your own research, some state constitutional protections for the right to vote are read very broadly, providing more protection for voters, but many are not. Many are not seen as any broader than the protections in the U.S. Constitution. And so we can think about action state by state. And so when we talk about election reform, it can happen at the local level, it can happen at the state level. And in terms of 2024, because things are so decentralized, there is so much that can be done. If you want to be a poll worker, or you want to be an election observer, you want to work with a political party or with a, you know, a good government group like the League of Women Voters, there are just a lot of opportunities to assure that the 2024 election is going to be fairly conducted and voters have access to be able to vote if they are eligible.
So are you optimistic about voting in elections? You know, as you know from my work and our conversations, I tend to be the optimist in the room when we're at election law conferences. What about you? Are you optimistic? And how do we stay optimistic during this time of kind of doom and gloom swirling our democracy?
I don't think I would use the word optimistic, but what I would say is that I'm determined that I think what we saw in the threats to elections over the last few election cycles is that people are no longer taking for granted that we will have a functioning democracy, that we'll have peaceful transitions of power, that elections will be fairly run. And so that's a call for activism. That's a call for people to ensure that we continue to have a strong and functioning democracy. And so when people are paying attention, they're more likely not to have their rights taken away, and they're more likely to advocate for strengthening those rights. So I look ahead to the future, and I think that especially when I speak to my students, when I speak to young people, they're concerned about the future. They're concerned about the future of American democracy. And with this book, I'm trying to give them some tools to think about how we can make things better for the future.
Let's dive into that answer a little bit more to ask this kind of fundamental question. Why should people vote? What's the point? I mean, you know, Republicans in your state of California, Democrats in my state of Kentucky, you know, who we sort of know who's going to win those states in the presidential election. So why bother voting in the first place?
Well, aside from the fact that it is one of the powers that we the people have to help to choose our leaders, we're not just choosing a president. You know, if you live in a local area, you might have much more influence, not over who the president's going to be, but who's going to be on your city council, who's going to be on your county board of supervisors, or in your state representatives. These people make decisions that affect all of our lives, and they are responsive to what voters want. This is one of the things that we know, is that politicians want to be reelected. They want their policies to be put in place. They want the support of voters. And so we shouldn't think of this as only about the U.S. presidential election. That, of course, gets so much more attention than everything else. But we're voting. We in the United States vote on more offices than anywhere else in the world. I mean, we just have so many elections. And that means there's lots of room to be able to have a voice in who is going to help to govern us.
Rick Hassin is a professor of law and the author of the new book, A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
It was great to speak with you.
Josh, I think most people assume that voting is a right that's enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, but it seems it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, you know, we spoke with Rick Hassan about how the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly confer a constitutional right to vote, although there is case law that protects it, and Rick's proposal is trying to make that case law into a constitutional amendment. But as he mentioned, every state has its own constitution, and virtually every one of them does explicitly grant the right to vote. In fact, 49 of the 50 state constitutions include language saying that citizens are qualified voters or are entitled to vote. The only state's constitution that does not explicitly confer the right to vote is Arizona's, but its state's courts have construed its state constitution as protecting voters. So we can say that all 50 state constitutions safeguard the right to vote. In addition, about half of the state constitutions have a clause saying that elections shall be free, free and equal, or free and open. Several state courts have relied on those clauses to strike down partisan gerrymanders or other laws that harm voters, although other state courts have narrowly interpreted their state constitutions in a way that fails to protect voters. I wrote about these state constitutional clauses in a scholarly article about a decade ago titled The Right to Vote Under State Constitutions, and I've just followed up that article with a new scholarly paper titled The Power of the Electorate Under State Constitutions. In it, I look more holistically at all 50 state constitutions to highlight how they actually have many parts that protect voters. I identify what I call a multi-layered right to vote under state constitutions. I then argue that state courts should invoke this multi-layered right to vote to strike down laws that make it harder for the electorate to participate in elections. I think Rick is correct that we need a constitutional amendment to better safeguard the right to vote within the U.S. Constitution, but we also shouldn't overlook the fact that state constitutions already protect voters. We just need to convince judges to use those clauses in a way that promotes democracy.
Rick proposes an amendment to the Constitution. How many amendments are there?
There's currently 27. If his amendment were ratified, it would be the 28th. And in fact, the story of the 27th Amendment is pretty interesting. That amendment regulates congressional pay, saying that any salary raise for members of Congress will not take effect until the next election. This way, members of Congress can't directly give themselves a raise. In 1789, James Madison proposed this amendment along with 11 others. Each of these were passed by a two-thirds vote of the House and Senate as required, but not all were ratified by the required three-quarters of the states. 10 were ratified in 1791. Those are your familiar federal Bill of Rights. At the same time, only 6 states had ratified what would become the 27th Amendment. The amendment lost traction back then and largely fell into obscurity. But it was resurrected in 1982 by an unlikely individual. Gregory Watson, a University of Texas sophomore, stumbled upon the forgotten amendment while researching for a paper for his government class. He received a C on that paper, which ignited Watson's passion for the cause. As he told an NPR reporter, "I thought right then and there, I'm going to get that thing ratified." He contacted lawmakers all over the country. Maine Senator William Cohen responded and helped convince Maine legislators to ratify the amendment in 1983, which then sparked a nationwide movement. By 1992, after over 202 years, the necessary 38 states had ratified the amendment, leading to its official inclusion in the U.S. Constitution. As Watson put it, "I wanted to demonstrate that one extremely dedicated, extremely vocal, energetic person could push this through. I think I demonstrated that." His professor who gave him the C also felt some remorse after Watson successfully lobbied enough state legislatures to ratify the amendment. In 2017, 35 years after receiving the C, the professor signed a form to officially change Watson's grade to an A.
Oh, that's great. And Josh, you always ask your guests this question, so I'll ask you, what's one thing we can do to support democracy?
I think it's important for every American to know more about the U.S. Constitution. The National Constitution Center has a great online Constitution 101 course with videos on all aspects of the Constitution. I particularly like the 13th module on the right to vote. Check it out at the National Constitution Center's website, constitutioncenter.org.
Coming up in a moment.
We basically outsource our choice for president to six states, which are not representative of America at all, simply because of the way state legislatures allocate electoral votes.
Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Harvard and co-author of How to Steal a Presidential Election. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
This is WEKU arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Thursday, April 4th, the Grant County Public Library in Williamstown will host Speakers Bureau, Flower Power, Kentucky Pollinator Protection Plan presented by Tammy Horn Potter. The program will begin at 5:30 p.m. On Sunday, April 7th, Mount Zion Christian Church in Richmond will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Johnny Green, and Orphan Survival, 1841 to 1920. The show will begin at 2:30 p.m. And on Monday, April 8th, the Cynthiana Harrison County Public Library in Cynthiana will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Roscoe Tarleton Goose, Kentucky Derby winner. The performance will begin at 5:30 p.m. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky Election Law and Voting Research Professor Josh Douglas.
2020 saw unprecedented attacks on the results of the presidential election, even though there was no evidence whatsoever to question its results. It wasn't just January 6th. There was a sustained attempt to quite literally overturn the election result from November through January. There were legal memos about how to exploit the Constitution and federal law to change the outcome. Could that happen again in 2024? To answer that question, today we are speaking with Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School. He's the author, with Matthew Seligman, of a new book titled How to Steal a Presidential Election. Larry, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So first, your book has a really provocative title, How to Steal a Presidential Election. You know, some might criticize you for providing a roadmap for the next attempted coup, and you do address this in Chapter 1. But tell us, why write a book that outlines just how to do it?
Well, I think what we saw in 2020 is that it's actually very complicated to understand what the rules are and how to apply them properly, because we actually saw that the rules were not being applied properly in 2020 on January 6th. Kentucky has a senator, Rand Paul, who I think was unique among Republicans, and Mitch McConnell was the same, but was very clear about the inappropriateness of questioning the votes from states like the state of Pennsylvania. You might have views about whether Pennsylvania counted their votes correctly or not. You might have views about whether the absentee ballots should have been included or not. Those views are perfectly appropriate. Have them however you want. But the Constitution only gives Congress the power to count the votes. And the Electoral Count Act is quite clear that if the votes have been tallied in, if the electoral votes have been cast in a way that's regular, there's no coercion or bribery, and the process is completed 6 days before the electoral votes are to be counted or cast, then Congress has no power to question the results. Now, we think that might have been that those members just were not being honest about what the law required, or that it's just so complicated that even the press didn't quite understand what the law required. And so I think we thought, Matt and I thought, that this really is something we ought to get the conversation going months in advance, so that by the time we get to the election and Electors Day and January 6, 2025, then in the culture, at least there's an understanding of what could go wrong and what we have to defend against, so that we can get a result that we have some confidence in.
Now, you imagine a scenario in the book where the election between Biden and Trump is extremely close, and your hypothetical is that Trump wins the popular vote, but Biden wins the Electoral College, and the results in a state like North Carolina are put into question, or are very close to put into question. So why is that the right recipe? Why is that what we should be worrying about?
Well, I think that what 2020 actually showed us is that if the results are not actually close, and 2020 was not close compared to 2000, then we think the system holds. So, you know, even very partisan actors like Governor Kemp and Raffensperger, Secretary of State Raffensperger in Georgia, who were deeply committed to President Trump, felt like they had to do the right thing. And they had to do the right thing because there was no plausible basis for them to actually think anything other than what they said was the result. But if things are extremely close, and there are a lot of questions about whether the vote was properly administered, whether certain ballots should be counted, maybe there's a concern that there's certain illegal votes that were cast, it becomes easier to build momentum around resisting the result. And if it's one state that decides it, like Florida in 2000, then enormous pressure is going to be put on the electors and the administrators of that system to flip the result one way or the other. So we think it's first of all important to emphasize our system isn't broken in the sense that no matter what, it can, you know, the election can be stolen. We think it can be stolen in a case where there's a fog of war and there's enough moving parts to convince a public that there's a reason to do something extraordinary. You know, the striking fact about today is the number of people who believe the 2020 election was stolen is the same as the number of people who believed it was stolen on January 6, 2021, which means that we, you know, I don't think it was stolen. I don't think there's any evidence that it was stolen. But that is because I live in a world where I see one set of facts, and I guess other people see different sets of facts. And that reality creates the potential for this opportunity that we've written this book to identify.
I mean, but isn't there something to suggest that a super close election is, you know, it's sort of hard to know who actually won? I mean, you know, in Bush v. Gore in 2000, if you do the count one way in Florida, Gore wins. If you do the count in another way, Bush wins. The certified result was Bush wins by 537 votes out of millions cast. I mean, it's a statistical tie. So why is this a stolen election if the scenario you're envisioning is essentially a statistical tie and the landslide election doesn't cause as many problems?
Well, I don't think 2000 was a stolen election, but it's a very illustrative election for the kind of problems we've identified. So first of all, you know, the Gore campaign made a profound mistake in conceding that everything needed to be completed by what's called Safe Harbor Day, 6 days before the electors are to cast their vote. And again, I think this is just, it was just, you know, ignorance, not stupidity, but ignorance. They just didn't know the history. Because in 1960, in Hawaii, you know, the first results from Hawaii gave the state to Nixon, and he was certified as the winner. And then the Democrats noticed tabulation errors, and so they said, we want a recount. And so they started the recount, but they noted, they realized they couldn't complete the recount before the electors would cast their votes. So they continued the recount, and the Democratic electors for Kennedy met on the same day in the same palace, the Hawaiian monarch's palace, and cast their ballots for Kennedy when the Nixon electors met and cast their ballots for Nixon. These were the first, quote, fake electors. That is how we would refer to them today. And then the results came in for Kennedy, and Kennedy was certified on, I think it's December 30th, 1960, and they immediately shipped off the certification to the Capitol so that it could be there by January 6th. Now, the point is that that reality, that way of handling ties or recounts seems to me perfectly sensible. But they didn't allow that to happen in Florida because they all thought there was some obsessive need to resolve this 6 days before the election, which there's no obligation to under the Constitution. And it certainly was in Gore's great disfavor because what subsequent analyses of that election showed is that if there was a full recount, which is what the Republicans were calling for, full recount in every county, Gore would have won. And if there was a targeted recount, which is what Gore was asking for, in just some of those counties, then Bush would have won. So, you know, if you just allow the system to work itself out and do, you know, a complete recount when it's so close, and let's just make sure we're really sure, you could have gotten to the right result. Now, that example, though, creates a real risk in the next election, because the rules that governed in 1960 under the Electoral Count Act have been changed by the Electoral Count Reform Act. Under the Electoral Count Reform Act, Nixon's votes would be counted, not Kennedy's votes, because the Electoral Count Reform Act says the governor has to certify 6 days before the election. There's nothing about the governor certifying after the electors have cast their ballots. And you can object to counting the governor's certified results, but the only basis for objecting is to say that the certification was improper, but Nixon was properly certified when he was certified, or the votes of the electors were not regularly given. But they were regularly given. They were given for Nixon, just like they were expected to be given. So there's, in the new law, no basis for allowing this kind of orderly recount to occur, which we think is a really profound mistake, because it creates enormous incentive to slow the process down. If you are the presumptive winner, but you're anxious that the recount might actually favor the other side, you know, just delay it. And if you delay it till after the electors vote, then if the law is applied the way the law is written, there's nothing to fix it afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a big potential problem. So in the book, you mentioned 7 possible strategies to steal a presidential election, 4 of which you say probably wouldn't work, but 3 that could. So what keeps Larry Lessig up at night in terms of the 2024 election and the potential of it being stolen?
Well, the one that keeps me awake is one I also kind of feel a little guilty about. You know, in 2016, there were a bunch of electors from Washington and Colorado who, seeing that Trump was going to win only because he was going to have more electoral votes, but he didn't have more actual votes, thought that they should work together with Republican electors to cast their ballots for some Republican other than Trump, and therefore to throw it into the House of Representatives and give the House of Representatives a chance to decide whether it would affirm Trump as the president or pick another Republican as the president. Nobody expected they would pick Hillary Clinton. And when they did this in Washington, they were fined $1,000 each. And in Colorado, they were kicked off as electors. And it was my view that the Constitution plainly imagined that electors had a constitutional discretion to actually cast their ballots as they thought appropriate. So I thought that they were completely privileged to vote however they wanted. And so I volunteered to take their case to the Supreme Court. And we got into the Supreme Court in, I think it's May of 2020, sitting in my office, because it was the first week of remote arguments, sitting on a phone, they didn't even have Zoom, was arguing the case to the Supreme Court, arguing that, in fact, these electors were constitutionally free. They couldn't be controlled by state legislatures. But the court decided 9-0, essentially, that state legislatures had the power to tell electors how they must vote. Okay, so here's the scenario that's most terrifying to me. Imagine a very, very close election. Let's say Wisconsin's a great example here, because the legislature in Wisconsin is still a very gerrymandered legislature. They've just changed the rules, but that won't have any effect in this election cycle. So you can imagine the legislature looks at the results and says, look, we don't actually believe that, let's say, Biden is declared the winner, but it's extremely close. Let's say we don't actually think Biden was the winner. We think there's too much fraud or too many bad ballots, or they had these drop boxes they shouldn't have had or whatever. And so what they do is pass a law or a resolution, depending on your view of the constitutional power of state legislatures, that says the electors from Wisconsin must vote for Donald Trump. Now, under the rule of the Supreme Court, that law is valid. And the Supreme Court said that electors have, quote, themselves no rights, end quote. So if you're a Biden elector and you're told you must vote for Trump, your choice is either to resign or vote for Trump. And if you resign, they'll replace you with a Trump elector. So this is a strategy which the court has opened up that I don't think anybody intended. And maybe if I'd been more persuasive, we could have like gotten the court to go the other way. But it creates this opportunity that nobody had really thought of before because it wasn't really an option before. And that's the one that I'm actually most fearful could be deployed in a strategic way to flip the results.
So I'm with you in terms of I'm afraid of this as well if this happened before the election, right? If today or if on, you know, October 30th, the Wisconsin legislature passed a law that said, we hereby declare our Electoral College votes go to Donald Trump. I think there's nothing in the Constitution that would prevent that. I'm not yet convinced by your argument that if the Wisconsin legislature did this after the people have voted in Wisconsin, that there would not be a successful due process challenge here. So what I'm imagining is, you know, the, you know, in November 15th or whatever, Wisconsin legislature says, you know, we don't care that the state voted for Biden. We're going to require the electors to vote for Trump, even if the Biden electors are the ones that are appointed. Wouldn't this raise a due process challenge in that the state has allowed people to vote and now they're taking it away by not crediting what the people voted for?
Well, first, the state would never say Biden won, but we're going to flip the results. What the state would say is the results are so unsure and complicatedly messy that we don't think that there's any will expressed by what the people did in the vote. And so therefore, we're going to express what we think the will of the people in Wisconsin is. And in North Carolina and Texas, both had laws that effectively gave the state legislature in Texas, the governor or the state legislature in North Carolina, the power to do exactly that. But secondly, I do think that if you had time to litigate the question, I don't know whether it would be due process or the First Amendment, or, you know, just a reinterpretation of the Cefalo case, the case that originally interpreted the power of the state legislature to control how electors vote. I don't know what the basis would be. I'm quite sure the court would find a way to stop the legislatures from doing that. But again, the timing here is so critical because let's say that the state legislature passes this in the first week after the election, or let's say that they pass that rule a couple days before the Electoral College is supposed to vote. Okay, so, you know, you're a law professor. Tell me how quickly the Supreme Court can take this case up and then resolve it. And if they don't resolve it before the electors vote, again, under the Electoral Count Act right now, there's no basis for objecting to how the electors would be voting. You know, one big theme in our book is if we lived in a time where we could trust the good faith of everybody, I don't think it would matter because they would do the right thing. They'd like figure the right thing out, just like Nixon oversaw the counting of Hawaii in 1961, and Nixon decided to give the electoral votes to Kennedy because that was just the right thing to do. But the whole point of where we are right now is if everybody's playing constitutional hardball and you're doing whatever you can to save the union, and both sides think that they're trying to save the union, then there'll be a real temptation to just play the rules exactly as they're written. And the Electoral Count Reform Act of 2022 doesn't give any easy way to fix this problem.
So what do we do now between now and, you know, November or now and January 6, 2025?
Well, I think one really great thing is we lay out these scenarios, four of which we think are plausible. What we need is people like you and other like leading figures in like the legal academy and in the public sphere to begin to talk about how to resist them or why they're wrong or why this isn't, in fact, how we ought to be running an election, so that the playbooks are set and set in advance clearly enough so we know how to resist this kind of problem if it comes up. I think that's the most we can do. You know, we're not going to get a case in the Supreme Court to resolve this before the election. There's just no standing to raise that kind of claim. And, you know, I think that even if you did get it in the Supreme Court, the court is, I think, now increasingly allergic to getting close to deciding these kinds of questions. So it would try to avoid it. What we've been trying to do in the book and more generally is just to get people to focus on what is the weakness in this system and what understanding and will do we have to build in response to that to make sure that the results are not contrary to what they should be. And we think what they should be is take the votes in every state, find the winner, allocate the electoral votes according to that, and the electoral winner then should be president, whether that's the person who won the popular vote or not, our rule says the electoral count winner should be president.
Mm-hmm. Final question for you, because we're talking a lot about the presidential election. Why should people even bother voting? You know, in a state like Kentucky or a state like Massachusetts or California or Texas, where the result seems preordained. What's the point? Why should people who are listening even bother going out to vote?
Yeah, you should be really angry in Kentucky, just like we should be really angry in Massachusetts and people in California and Texas the same. Because as crazy as people consider the idea of like a legislature declaring what the results will be in advance, you know, if the Wisconsin legislature said on October 30th, as you said, this state will go for Donald Trump, people would think that's outrageous because we're supposed to have elections. But in effect, all but about eight states in the United States have decided who's going to win in advance because they allocate electors according to something called the winner-take-all rule. Meaning if you get just a plurality of votes, you get all the electors in your state. So in 1992, Bill Clinton got 37% of the vote in Nebraska, and he got all the electoral votes in Nebraska because they had a winner-take-all system in 1992. So the point is that we have systems in the states to basically make irrelevant these states in presidential elections. No Republican candidate would spend any time in Kentucky or in Massachusetts, because in Kentucky, they know they already won. In Massachusetts, they know they're never going to win. And same thing with a Democrat. No Democrat would spend time in Kentucky. She's never going to win in Kentucky and wouldn't spend any time in Massachusetts because you know you're going to win in Massachusetts. And what academics have demonstrated is these non-swing states lose in federal regulations, in federal funding compared to the swing states. Like what the candidates are worried about is making sure Michigan and Wisconsin and Nevada and Arizona are happy. And they're going to do whatever they can to make sure that those swing states are happy. And that's a completely ridiculous way to run a presidential election. We basically outsource our choice for president to six states, which are not representative of America at all, simply because of the way state legislatures allocate electoral votes. And that could be different. That's not in the Constitution. We could change that tomorrow, but there isn't yet a recognition of just how crazy this is. And so we live with this system where six states are going to decide who the next president will be.
Yeah. Professor Larry Lessig of Harvard Law School is the author with Matthew Seligman of How to Steal a Presidential Election. Larry, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, you talked with Lawrence Lessig about the Electoral Count Act, and I think a lot of us are confused about this. How did this come about in the first place?
Yeah, so Congress passed the Electoral Count Act of 1887 after the close and hotly contested election in 1876 between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes. Congress had realized that there was no sound mechanism in place to resolve the disputed election, which actually involved the dispute in four different states that the commission Congress created said Hayes won all four to win the election. But after that happened, Congress realized it needed a better mechanism, so it enacted the Electoral Count Act to offer detailed procedures. The law is extremely complex and convoluted, and it's those complexities that President Trump and some of his supporters sought to exploit in 2020. Well, you might think Congress can't do really anything in a bipartisan way these days, but at the end of 2022, Congress passed the Electoral Count Reform Act to update this law. The updates include two major changes, among other tweaks. First, the law raises the threshold to pause the count and trigger debate about a state's electoral votes to one-fifth of each house. In 2020, an objection required just a single member of each house, which, as you'll recall, at least one member of the House and one member of the Senate used to object to the electoral count votes in places like Arizona and Pennsylvania. Now the law would require one-fifth of each house. Second, the law explicitly states that the vice president's role while presiding over the joint session shall be limited to performing solely ministerial duties. This means that you can't ask the vice president to make a substantive decision not to count certain electoral votes from states, as President Trump had tried to get Vice President Pence to do. These two reforms take away some of the most significant ways in which President Trump and his supporters sought to change the results in 2020, Let's hope there are not other vulnerabilities in the system in 2024.
Okay, let's get another fun election fact.
You might wonder how one becomes an elector in the Electoral College. Who are these people? Well, if we look at the Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, simply states that electors cannot be a member of Congress or hold any federal office. Under the 14th Amendment, electors also can't be anyone who has, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States or given aid or comfort to its enemies, which is the same language in controversy over whether President Trump was eligible to run for president in 2024. The Constitution says the state legislators determine the manner of choosing the state's electors, and all states now let the voters decide. In 48 states, the winner of the statewide vote receives all of the state's electoral votes, while Maine and Nebraska split the Electoral College votes by congressional district. But again, who exactly are these people? The states defer this selection of the actual people to the political parties. Most commonly, a slate of electors is nominated and confirmed by a vote at the statewide political party convention. Generally, the party members selected to be electors are party leaders and officials who are well connected with the right people. So when you vote for president, you're actually voting for electors, real people who are pledged to vote for that candidate when the electors meet in mid-December. By the way, while some states require the electors to vote for the candidate who won the statewide popular vote, other states leave the choice open to the electors, which raises the possibility of so-called faithless electors, as Professor Lessig discussed.
And give us another thing we can do to support democracy.
Better informed voters create a better democracy. So maybe you want to know who exactly are the electors from your state. The National Archives website has this information for previous elections. Go to www.archives.gov/electoral-college, and toward the bottom, click on See Who My State's Electors Are. That will give you a chart that has links for each state with the official certificates of electors. You can find the official Electoral College submissions that each state sends to Congress for tallying on January 6th after each election year.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, I'm series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer, Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.